Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to my show. Today, October the 3rd, 2023, I'm interviewing Professor Parks Kobo about his new book, The Collapse of Nationalist China, How Chiang Kai-shek Lost China's Civil War, published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. Parks, thank you so much for sitting down with me to chat about your new book, which I like so much. So for our listeners, could you please make self-introduction, tell us where you were born, for example, where you went to school, how you became interested in writing such a book, and who has inspired you, etc. Thank you so much, Parks.
Well, thank you, Dong, for inviting me to do this. I was born and grew up in South Carolina, and I went to the University of South Carolina as an undergraduate, where I developed a strong interest in Chinese studies. This was several decades ago, and there weren't a lot of places to study. And I was really interested in Republican China, which was a field that really had not been developed very much. So I went to the University of Illinois, where I was fortunate to study with the late Lloyd Eastman, one of the pioneers of the field. And after getting my PhD, I got a job at the University of Nebraska, where I had been teaching for over 40 years. This book actually is a throwback in some ways, because in the acknowledgments, I dedicated in memory of Lloyd Eastman, because the questions I'm trying to answer in this book were ones that came up literally half a century ago in classes I was taking with him. And I now feel that I was in a position to work on them and answer them.
That's great to know that you are a former student of Lloyd Eastman. Great. And I read, obviously, many of his brilliant works. I enjoyed reading your new book immensely, Parks, especially the last four chapters and conclusion. And I think at some point it was quite amusing to see you wrote yourself into the episode of history involving ROC and Chiang Kai-shek. So you've done a great service to the academic community and civil society. Research on World War II's China theater and the history of Republic of China in the mainland is abundant. Given Chiang Kai-shek's prominence as the leader of nationalist China and later Taiwan, or rather the Republic of China in Taiwan, from 1927 or 28 approximately to his death in 1975. Many people have written about him. So how different is your work? What main messages do you intend to convey to the readers, Parks?
Well, as you know, this isn't really a biography of Chiang Kai-shek at all. It's really an analysis of what is really a pivotal period when the nationalists lost the mainland to the communists. And what I try to do is understand his leadership style. And as you know from reading the book, I focused on a really particular issue, the issue of hyperinflation. Through that lens, I tried to understand what I thought were some problems with his leadership role. Zhang did many things that worked out very well, and he did a good job in some ways of changing direction on the island of Taiwan. But this was a major failure. And so I think that's what I was really focusing on. As you know from the book, I really went back to that issue of hyperinflation. Government of China, after the Japanese invaded, had, of course, retreat inland to Chongqing and Sichuan, and they lost most of their revenue base from the East Coast. And so they found themselves running big deficits. And Zhang just basically had them keep printing money. And when you just print money that isn't really backed you end up with inflation and then hyperinflation. So just for an example, the base that I used was the 6 months before the war started, January to June 1937, and a mythical item that had cost one kwai. By the time of Pearl Harbor, would have been almost 20 kwai, which isn't really that bad. But after Pearl Harbor and the Pacific War, China's even more cut off. And so they kept rolling the money out so that by December of 1944, that item would cost 755 kwai. And on the time of Japanese surrender, it would cost a staggering 2,647. So it really, the value of the currency was just gutted. And then after the war, there was a brief retreat, but by July 47, that same item would be almost 30,000 kwai. And when FABI, the legal tender system, was abandoned for the gold yuan on August 21st, 1948, almost 5 million. So something you bought on the street in 1937 would cost you 5 million. And this was really a devastating policy, I think, in many ways. So what I tried to do was to understand there were two questions I thought that had not been answered. Eastman worked very much on the impact of this on the ability of the Nationalist Army, talked about the corruption and how it really did not fare well in the Ichigo campaign late in the war against Japan or later against the communists. And there were the two questions I thought were, first of all, China won the war. You know, they were on the winning side. And the argument had always been, well, they retreated inland. They couldn't get their tax revenue. They lost maritime customs. But after the war is over, they were back on the East Coast. They could tax tariffs. There was a lot of damage, but many of the textile mills, for example, were back in operation within a few months. The harvest was pretty good, both rice and cotton. So why couldn't they break the chain and get rid of the hyperinflation? They had assistance from the United States, including the money that came through the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration that provided substantial aid. China was the largest recipient of that aid after the war, and they couldn't do that. And the second thing was just the fairly obvious question is, everybody looked at this and they thought that it was an insane policy. I mean, it wasn't getting the job done. And no one could quite figure out why they couldn't change the policy. It was sort of like a train careening down a track toward a ravine where the bridge is out. And they put barriers up and they, you know, signal. And the engineer just keeps shoveling more coal in the engine and the train speeds up. Everybody knows it's going to be a disaster. So those are the two questions. Now, I should say, these came up in my graduate studies half a century ago, but I started graduate school in 1968, which means I'm really old. But of course, that was the height of the Cultural Revolution. And when I finished my degree, Mao was still alive. When I started at Nebraska, I'd never been to the mainland. And as an American, the first time I went, and not long after that, was on one of those U.S.-China People's Friendship Tours that were highly structured. Frankly, it was 20 years before I ever did any real academic research in mainland. I worked in Taiwan, but Chiang Kai-shek was still alive. And the archives were controlled not by the government as they are today, but by the Kuomintang Party. And they were really not helpful. So new sources had to open up, and they have in the last few years.
Yeah, but the topics you pursued, Park, are so much relevant to our today's world. You know, it's a fantastic case study for many of us to reflect upon from different angles. So to me, it's fascinating to explore, particularly the financial economic side of the political collapse of the Republic of China in the mainland. It's highly relevant, as I said. So maybe we will get into more details in a moment. But first, may I ask you about the archival and library work you conducted? Can I ask you, What kind of primary and secondary sources you used to make the case? And also, I'm curious, were there any sources that surprised you besides you found yourself actually in the archives?
Maybe I'll explain that last reference. At the end of the book, I had followed the career of T.B. Song and H.H. Kung, and they left China. They did not, well, Kung visited Taiwan, but they didn't go to Taiwan, came to the States. And the Sterling Seagrave published this book called The Song Dynasty, in which he just repeated a lot of stuff that he didn't really have evidence for. He said that they were among the richest men in the world, and they had stole all this money, and their fortune could be $6 billion for Song. And so at the Hoover Archives, the friend of T.B. Song, who had been the executor of his estate, an American who had worked with China during the war, probated his estate. And, you know, he wasn't poor, but it was $10 million, which is rich, but it isn't $6 billion or one of the richest people in the world. But as I'm reading in the archives in the Hoover Institute, I come across a letter he sent to Song's daughter and some of his grandchildren recommending my first book, the Shanghai Capitalist and the Nationalist Government of China. And I thought, you know, you're really old when you find yourself in the archives. But that was quite a surprise, I guess I would say.
Yeah, but I think it can be a tribute to your long-lasting, brilliant scholarship that can stand the test of time. And yeah, I think that's probably the good part about being an academic means professionally, in general, we are required to be neutral, not to take really very, of course, we have to base our judgment on the sources available to us. So I think that is a nice compliment to you.
Well, going back to that question of sources, as I said, 50 years ago, I couldn't approach working on these questions. There were no sources. And so I didn't know if I ever would work on it. But then about a decade ago or so, I decided I could. The foundation of a lot of the study is actually Chinese scholarship, my scholars in mainland China, who are cited in the text, who began to work on Chiang Kai-shek. And I think the diaries stimulated a lot of that work, or at least spurred it on. I did particularly single out Professor Wu Jingping of the History Department at Fudan, who invited me over. I think there were seven conferences I got invited to, all basically on this topic. And I was allowed to present a paper at these and got critiques and suggestions from Chinese scholars. And as you know, when you go to a conference in China, at least in the old days before COVID, you would bring a suitcase full of books and you would exchange books, and I would come back with all this new scholarship. The second thing was the Hoover Institution. Most of the archival material I use there, the T.B. Song papers, the H.H. Kung papers, Arthur Young's papers, I think I used a dozen different major collections there in this book. And they just have become this, of course, the diaries are there, the centerpiece for a lot of work on Republican China. And then finally, Taiwan really just opened up the archives, which are now really controlled by the government. But I particularly cited the secretariat of Chiang Kai-shek had this daily record of everything he did. And the photo facsimile reprint done by the Guo Shiguan, 86 volumes. Each volume is several hundred pages. They cover 2 to 3 months. And they're not easy to read. They're mostly handwritten. But everything he did from the time he got up, he usually had Bible study or this, that, or the other. Every person he met, documents he got, documents were written under his name, occasionally quoting from the diaries, even things like went strolling with Madame Zhang after dinner, or sometimes he would say gazed at fish, which I assume means meditation in front of a fish pond. I don't know. But I mean, the thing about it was, Chiang Kai-shek is still very elusive. Even you read the diaries, you don't really quite understand what he's thinking and what he's not telling you. But you can figure out what he did every minute of every day and what he didn't do. And one thing he didn't do was really meet with financial officials. He was very focused on military, but he left the finances go way too long, which I think was the problem.
Yeah, that's true. My impression of Zhang, of course, is that he was quite morally self-examining, you know, a very disciplined person. But of course, he came from this military background. So in that sense, it is no surprising that he focused on the military dimension of governing the ROC in the mainland, of course, dealing with the Chinese Communist Party. So that is really quite interesting for you to make that conclusion, to point to the financial side, actually his disadvantages during his years in the mainland. But very often, I also feel he's kind of he was kind of unlucky, but let's get into that later when we discuss his years in Taiwan. Now, you wove your story chronologically, starting from the sharp turn of Nationalist China's fate around late 1944 and early 1945. So on the one hand, Chiang Kai-shek was riding high with great success in elevating the Republic of China to a great power status. He was really quite a nationalist with the support of President Roosevelt. Chiang's China was holding the China seat and vetoing right as one of the five permanent member states on the United Nations Security Council until 1971. We know that to this day, actually, India is still pursuing that kind of status. So on the other hand, Japan's Operation Ichigo, a successful military campaign carried out in nationalist China, caused great difficulty for Chiang Kai-shek's government to fund its 8 million soldiers, arguably. How did the loss to Japan of many Chinese productive areas impact hyperinflation, Chinese banks, exchange rate of nationalist China's currency, and Chiang Kai-shek's relations with the United States? It's a long question.
One of the statistics I gave at the earlier was that between January 1945 and August, hyperinflation actually accelerated dramatically. And that's really the result of Ichigo, because about half of the area of nationalist China was cut off. So the rice from Hunan and areas like that, they've been requisitioning rice directly from peasants. So all of those soldiers retreated, but all the rice just had to come from Sichuan, which actually worsened things fairly dramatically. But the other thing is that hyperinflation is kind of a psychological thing. When you got paid in Fabi for anything, it's hot money. It's losing value literally by the hour. So everybody frantically rushes out and buys anything they can, because they don't want to hold the money. And that creates this psychology of hyperinflation. And so like you would rush out, you could buy gold or silver if it was illegal, but on the black market, or you would even buy things like a bag of flour, which is a problem because it could deteriorate with vermin and, you know, mold, but it was better than holding this currency. And as a consequence, Arthur Young, who was a financial advisor earlier in that year, had thought that they could get out of this conundrum, but he anticipated the war would last longer than it did. Nobody knew about atomic bomb, of course. But I think that in China, because Japan had been so successful when 45 started, they control more territory than ever. They thought the war was going to go on, and everybody thought there would be an amphibious landing on the southeast coast of China. United States was helping, working with Dai Li to train commandos. The Japanese thought so. They actually repositioned their troops well into June. And I think he thought that if they could do that and establish a beachhead, then a port could open up and commodities could flow into China. And once that happened, people who had been hoarding would suddenly want to get rid of their stuff because they thought prices would go down. Now, that didn't happen. And the other thing was most of the people living in eastern and southeastern China were using, the people in the occupied areas, currency issued by the Wang Jingwei government. And they wanted to, he said they could, in an orderly fashion, retire those notes. Well, when Japan suddenly surrendered, China didn't, well, I mean, Zhang wasn't there on the East Coast. You know, it just, the bombs fell, the Soviet Union enters the war, Japan surrenders, and the United States has to really help airlift soldiers back. American Marines landed in many of the coastal cities, and they basically trashed the Wang Jingwei government. They valued it way undervalued. It was a big mistake. And so most of the people in the occupied area were impoverished, but they had to get FAB because they needed it. So all these people, they called them the vultures, flew in from or came in from Sichuan and started buying things up, gold, silver, whatever. And that just set off inflation all over again. By October of 1945, inflation had come roaring back. The psychology was never broken. And I think that was, and then American sailors and soldiers were spinning right and left. I mean, it just, the whole thing just kind of, the Ministry of Finance did a study and said, well, yes, there was a, it was unpublished. There was a period of a few weeks where prices went down. And then by the fall, inflation hit Shanghai like a typhoon. It went right back in the same mold. And then Zhang decided that he wanted to print more money because he wanted to fight the communist, you know, with the military. There's this quote, I'll just read this from Arthur Young's private diary. It is a great pity for China that Zhang does not understand finance and will still take action without consulting those who do. He feels that those who predicted financial collapse before are wrong and that it will not happen. He got the country through 8 years of war and now wants his own way with spending and finance. So I think that kind of sums it up. He had a set idea. He was kind of stubborn. Yes. And he didn't like people who weren't yes men, like many important leaders, I think. And as a result, he never quite got the bad news until it was kind of a disastrous situation.
Yeah, true. I got the impression that Chiang Kai-shek was stubborn. Indeed.
I think so.
Yeah, but, you know, he had that many American educated, actually, specialists, you know, other people who were doing finances and the economy. But it's just feel that this group of people didn't have really the huge influence upon him financially.
No, the last part of the book, as you know, I look at the style of leadership of Zhang, and actually this goes back to Eastman. When I was in grad school, he was working on the book called The Abortive Revolution about the Nanjing era, 10 years, 27 to 1937. And he thought one of the problems was Zhang tried to have, he had about 20 different job titles. He wanted to center power on himself. And his style was to set up competing agencies that duplicated each other and let them fight it out. And that way, it kept anyone from being too powerful. And for example, in the intelligence work, he had Dai Li and the military intelligence, and then he had the CC cliques, party intelligence. And they spent all of their time fighting each other. But one fallout from that was that it compromises their effectiveness because the communists and the Japanese just infiltrated the Kuomintang government and the party, and they had all kinds of intelligence that just, they didn't do a good job of the secret agencies. And I think that's part of it. Now, in finance, a lot of the book is devoted to the rivalry that develops between T.V. Song, Song Siwan, Madame Zhang's brother, of course, and his brother-in-law, who is Kong Shangqi, H.H. Kong, who's Sung Ai Ling's husband. And they both were American educated. But between from 27, really, until the end of the war with Japan, they were the two main focuses. Song was a finance minister, and then he was ousted because he would not do quite everything Zhang wanted. And Kong came in for 10 years. And they the rivalry kind of surprised me because I had worked on these people for a long time. But what happens in the Hoover archives is you get into all the personal correspondence. And the two men and other archives that had come out, you just see how they became, it was very bitter and personal, even though they still had kind of family things going on. But Sung was very ambitious, but he was not very, he was way too headstrong. And he, Zhang would get furious with him and he would be in the doghouse. And Kong was more easygoing. But Sung did not agree with some of these policies like the hyperinflation. But he was so ambitious, he wouldn't risk, after the first time he got really smacked down by Zhang, he would go along with it. And so it was actually under his watch that things got worse. And after Kong was kind of retired because he became too problematic, Zhang seemed to let other people like the Legislative Yuan, there were these vicious attacks on Song, and they got in the press. And, you know, they could censor those things if they wanted to. But I think Zhang wanted to be sure he kept them both at bay and he would get what he wanted, which was more money, as it were. So I think that was kind of the core of the book. I got to really look, I got an inside look at how Zhang operated. And his style of leadership. And of course you get, you know, I'm this correspondence there between Song Beiling and Song, TV Song and Song Qingling also, you know, this writing from her. So you really get a good idea of kind of the inner dynamics of the family, which you wouldn't get. I mean, some of these things, I went out to Hoover a long time ago and most of the archives, a lot of them were still closed, some of the Arthur Young stuff. I remember a lot of the TV Song collection was closed until Madame Zhang died, and you were supposed to wait. Well, of course, she lived to be, what, 104 or something like that.
Yeah, very long-lived.
Very long. So it wasn't until I realized they were all open that, you know, you could work on this. So
yes, thank you. Parks, do you think the high concentration of economic power in the hands of a few magnates created the problem, or you think Chiang Kai-shek himself shared more of the so-called blame during this period?
Well, I mean, go back to what you said earlier. He had a bad draw for this. I mean, the fact is, it would have been very difficult, given the large size of the military and the expenses and the isolation of China during the war, it would have been really difficult to have done much better. They could have done better. I guess I thought the pivotal thing was the failure to recognize that when the war ended, the top priority over even military should have been to stabilize the economy. But Zhang went whole headstrong into military action. And so he didn't reduce spending at all. You know, I think there's another quote if I can find it. I have a quote in the book from Claire Chennault, who was head of the Flying Tigers.
Yes.
And he was a true believer. He went to China to advise the Chinese government before Pearl Harbor. He stayed in the American military during the war there. He deeply admired Zhang and especially Madame Zhang. So when the war is over, he wanted to stay. He did stay and organize a commercial airlines called the Flying Tigers that later the CIA kind of took over. But he wanted to, he thought he could really help Zhang because he knew China, he knew aviation. And he, this is a letter he wrote to, if I can find it, the letter to General Wiedemeyer, who was the top American military commander at the time. And he said, "It may interest you to know that our airline payroll for the last 2 weeks weighed slightly over one ton in currency, and that it took five men 4 days to count it into bundles." And he has lost faith. He got over there. He cannot understand why they can't, you know, you can't operate an airline. He eventually had to close down, but it just became impossible. And he didn't understand why the government couldn't change their policy. And I think, you know, that's someone who was a true believer. And so I think this widespread feeling that the government is just not in control of the situation is off course, or go back to the train wreck, you know, ignoring the fact that the bridge is out is really a lot of what went wrong there in the Civil War period.
Yeah, speaking of the financial downfall of nationalist China, I wonder, Park, how his Chiang Kai-shek's chief rival, Mao Zedong, and the Communist Party financed their own army in wartime and the Civil War. Were they also the carpet beggars who capitalized on Japan's invasion of nationalist China? I mean, they were, the CCP has been very strong with strong on propaganda and persuasion, or whatever we want to term it, since the late 1920s. Yeah, they were very good at it. So I wonder how they survived, how they financed their army and personnel.
Well, as you know, in the book, I have almost nothing to say about the communists, but that's because a lot has been said. In other words, there's so much literature on how the communists won that I thought I would focus on the other side. But I think it goes back to the circumstances, the conditions of wartime China, both against the war with Japan and against the communist, were the communists were more effective. Their approach to organizing, being very low key in there, I mean, they're down with the people and taxing peasants and organizing them, and also living off the land a bit better. That was better suited to those conditions. Zhang tended to have a military that needed more money, more weapons. You know, it was his style. And in the long run, I think that proved to be less effective than what the communists were doing. The other thing is that in the Civil War period, I mean, Zhang did initially look like fairly well. I think that his strategy, military strategy, which has been debated over and over, left a lot of his units vulnerable because he stretched them out too far. But the bottom line is, when things started to go bad, whole armies defected. I mean, between what, November 48 and February 49, 1.5 million soldiers switched sides or, you know, surrendered. And I think a lot of that had to do with the low morale in the Kuomintang military, and some of that went back to the corruption and the poor treatment of the enlisted men, you know, who often the officers were raking money off, and you know, they weren't, the soldiers weren't getting proper food, and so on. Not all of them, but especially in Manchuria. But I'm a little kinder than Eastman was when he was writing, because I've actually read enough memoir literature and stuff to realize that it wasn't a matter of greed so much, or corruption in that sense. It was really a matter of survival. If your paycheck is virtually worthless, if you're going to survive, you've got to steal from the office. So you pilfer, you know, food or whatever, but that's what you need to get by. And it led to a real sharp decline in morale. And I think that's one reason. It was kind of like a house of cards collapsing.
Yeah, thank you. I have read some work on Mao's financing during the 1940s. It is allegedly said that they smuggle opium and other things to make ends meet. But anyway, so that is a totally different topic we could chat about later on. But do you think in hindsight, were there any real possibilities for Chiang Kai-shek and his arch enemy, Mao Zedong, to reconcile with each other, adopting, you know, a non-military approach to each other?
I really don't. I mean, I just think that by the time of the war with Japan, the two men and the two movements were totally at loggerheads. And the only time they ever pretended not to be was when Mao was sometimes trying to show that he would be to Stalin and Zhang to Truman, you know, that was, or Marshall. That was just, I mean, I don't think there was any real possibility because they were such bitter enemies by this point. And, you know, I guess I'm the type, you don't rewrite history. It happened the way it did. The reason they were in that position is a long history from the 20. I mean, these two men knew each other. They, you know, the two movements knew each other. There was a long, very bitter history from the 20s up to 49. That created the conditions and leadership. And I don't see any lost chance or any of that happening, but maybe in a parallel universe, it might've worked out, but it just wasn't in the cards in my view. Now, the other question you raised this earlier is how did Zhang sort of reinvent himself in Taiwan? And I haven't worked on this. It isn't a lot of good work out. And I'm drawing a blank on the scholar at the Hoover Institution, who published the book with Harvard on, Anyway, there's a lot of good work out on that. And I think there are a variety of things involved. But I think Zhang did learn something from the fall of the mainland. And a lot of the people that he had relied on in China, like his brothers-in-law, did not go to Taiwan. He had kind of a new set of people, and he incorporated a kind of new elite that I think were did a good job there in restoring an economic basis for what Taiwan became, with a lot of American aid and trade advantages and a Japanese-educated business class and that kind of thing from the colonial period. So there's a lot different in Taiwan, but that's a whole other story, as we say.
Yeah, no.
One thing I have learned is if you want to get a book done, you got to tell one story, finish it. Because I know some people just hang on to stuff, and it took me 10 years, 8 years for this book. And so that's long enough.
True. On the other hand, showing, you know, what is your viewpoint on China's past and ongoing problem? Does it, I mean, lie in its own top leader's obsession with unification? Or would you say unification of diverse aspirations and peoples throughout modern and contemporary history? Or should a structural, systemic one-person rulership be held responsible for the collapse of the Republic of China in 1949 in the mainland, as well as the financial troubles facing today's the People's Republic?
Well, I don't draw any particular statements out in the book, but obviously I point to the example of an authoritarian ruler who tried to centralize all power in himself, who was very stubborn and had difficulty changing policies. And any authoritarian ruler in human history, one of the things you have to do is not let your subordinates get too powerful. So you deliberately keep them weak and you don't really anoint a successor. And you know, you could see some of that in China today, where the cabinet kind of system that Deng Xiaoping had put in place has been replaced by more of a centralized authority in which power resides really with one person. And if he decides we should have zero COVID policy, and he can't change his mind until it's clear he has to, they don't explain it. They just say, okay, it's gone. And if there are problems with the new policy, the data isn't released. I mean, that's kind of the way I see things kind of going.
Yeah, let's maybe go back to the point you made earlier about the CCP infiltration of Chiang Kai-shek's army and the government. By the 1940s, I think this Soviet Bolshevism, militant anti-imperialism, radical nationalism, and communist autocracy beguiled so many Chinese intellectuals, businessmen, soldiers, peasants, and others. I have been reading quite a lot of memoirs written by some mainlanders, mainland Chinese professionals who went to actually university during the 1940s. And one thing that struck me is that, my goodness, they all actually recalled or confessed they were either the party member at the time, or they were the so-called, at the time, it's the progressive youth. So how would you assess the entrenched infiltration into Jiang's army and government by the CCP members to act as influencers from within?
Well, I mean, I think that you can understand the appeal that communism would have had at that time. And, you know, Jiang's approach to handling the student movement was just, you know, boom, squash it. And I think that, you know, like trying to revive Confucian learning and things like that, and it just did not appeal to the students. I think one of the striking things that I focused, though, was you can almost see that labor and students would not be pro-Jiang, but he lost the capitalist. I mean, that is, I haven't covered that, but in the chapter on the Gold Yuan reform, he alienated at the last minute virtually all of the capitalists, and a lot of them left China. Some of them came back, but you know, you'd think the capitalists would be against communism, but I think in 49, a lot of them weren't sure that it wouldn't be better. Now, by the 50s, they wouldn't have thought that, but at the time, I actually went to a conference, 15 years ago, Sherm Cochran organized at Cornell, about the original title of the conference is something, They Stayed, They Went Away, or They Came Back. It was about individual chapters on different capitalists who some left and never came back, some left and then came back, and they looked at the different alternatives. And essentially that alerted me at the time to the fact that that the capitalists really had lost faith in the Jiang government. Now, this is 49-50. And there was still movement at that time where, you know, if you had gone to Hong Kong, you could maybe go back, or you could leave China and go to Hong Kong, that kind of thing. But, you know, they had lost really a constituency that should have supported them. So it really is kind of a demoralization of the movement at that point. Well, I mean, I had the quote from Claire Chennault, you know, I mean, he's the true believer, the foreigner who believes in Jiang, and yet he wants to help, and yet he can't because he can't operate a business in under those conditions, you know.
Yeah, true. The irony is that for those who decided to stay, in 1949, 1950 to stay in the mainland. Later, obviously, they would have even a more miserable fate than those who followed Jiang to Taiwan. I would imagine it was such a humiliating experience for Chiang Kai-shek. Look at this man, you know, he worked hard to lift China to a great power status, and then he fought hard against Japanese invasion, and then then he was chased, retreat. He had to retreat to Taiwan. So have you encountered any sources on his own reflection on those humiliating years by the late 1940s?
I have not worked on this at all. Now, I was in Taiwan those years. I saw Chiang Kai-shek, I think one of the last times he appeared at Double Ten. And I was back in Taiwan when they dedicated the memorial. But I mean, I don't know. I think I haven't looked at this new biography of his entire life, lengthy biography by Alexander Pensoff. And perhaps I think he covers a lot the Taiwan period. So that might have some answers for that. But, you know, I really actually think that he thought that with American help, there would be an uprising in Taiwan and, I mean, China, and maybe he could retake the mainland. I mean, I mean, that's what they always said, but you could be self-delusional about that. And, you know, certainly when the Great Leap Forward was going on and the Cultural Revolution, you know, things did not look good on the mainland. And, you know, who knows? So he may have convinced himself that it was going to happen.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the 1970s of Taiwan. A moment ago, you mentioned you went there when Chiang Kai-shek was still alive. So how was it like as compared to today's Taiwan? It must have been very different, right?
Oh, yeah. Night and day. The food was good, the same. I mean, night and day. Well, first of all, when I went there, I was there almost not 2 years, a year and a half maybe. I was still studying language. And then I worked, Academia Sinica had a good library and they were very open, but they didn't really have much on the Nanjing period. There were a lot of publications. There were things like, you know, Zhuangji Wenxue, the biography journal, would publish all of these stories by all these people. And, you know, if you read through a lot of them, you got some idea of these people had been on the mainland, they ended up in Taiwan, and, you know, how they were thinking and that kind of thing. But at the Kuomintang Archives itself, they were, I mean, I went out there quite often, but you didn't really see what I would call archival stuff. I got to read, they had original copies of Guo Wanzhoubao, I think, the newspaper, and you could read those. And that was very helpful for that first book. I used a lot of that material, but now you can read that online or on microfilm, you know, anywhere really. But that was very helpful. But I didn't really see. I went down. I spent one day at the Chiang Kai-shek archives. Went then down at near Taichung and some, and I went down there and they greeted me and they took my picture and we had tea, and that was it. I didn't see any documents. So, and I knew Lloyd Eastman had worked there a lot. He told me, you know, you won't be able to see this and that and the other. And then I think every 60 or maybe every 90 days, you had to leave Taiwan, and I flew to Hong Kong, which of course is a British colony, and you could buy books there. And I did go to the University Service Center, but I wasn't working on the communists. So, but that was, you know, that was good to kind of get a broader perspective. And I did stop in Japan, and mostly just bought books there. So that was, you know, what I did as a graduate student in those days. But I didn't go to China. I think I took the train from Kowloon Station up to the border, what is now Shenzhen, and looked over with binoculars at Red China. That was it. So I didn't see Shanghai until I was already an assistant professor. And I had actually already published a book on Shanghai in the 30s. But at that day, in those times, it looked a lot like what it had looked like in the 30s. So I remember I went in the that Japanese hotel that was the old French club, and the marble staircase, and a British scholar and I were in the archives the next day, and he was looking at a picture from the 30s, and it was the same staircase. You know, they at that time, they Shanghai had not, there wasn't that much new there. So it was, and I'm glad I got to see it at that time, because if you are there today, you would never imagine what really the 70s would have been like, you know, and 80s even.
That's fascinating. I hope we will have another opportunity later on to chat about the 1970s. Very important era, of course. Anyway, Park, thank you so much. We've taken up a lot of your time. And I want to ask you a final question is, do you still plan to write something new later on?
Well, I won't say that I'm not, but I'm retiring at the end of this academic year. I'm not sure I have another book in me at this point, but I have enough material in my basement to make a good start. Originally, before I got this book finished, I was thinking I would like to write a study of the rise and fall of private banking in China, looking at the rise of the private banks, modern banks, and then through the consolidation in the early 50s. I'm not sure if that is what I'll do. I have a colleague in American history who's writing his memoirs, who's retired. And I thought, well, are mine really that interesting? But I'm thinking about it. So who knows? You know, when you get ready to retire, you start to reflect on all the things you've been through and what's happened and how different things are. And I'm not sure if they're that interesting, but I'll give it a thought anyway.
That's great. And thank you so much for spending the time with me today, Parks.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, have a good day.